Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Now, you hear me say this every week, but it's true. It is a lovely bit of kit. I use my cooker tap constantly, daily. Tea, I make tea with it. Americano coffees, I get myself a little espresso, maybe a double espresso. And then I add hot water straight from the cooker tap. Beautiful coffee. Cooking every night, pasta, rice, vegetables. Filtered water when I'm feeling thirsty and when I'm feeling a bit showbiz, which happens most Wednesdays, sometimes on a Saturday with lead up to Sunday brunch, I get myself a filtered sparkling water. Ooh, the bubbles. I absolutely love it. No, I do actually love my cooker tap. So I use all the time. It's just there. It's constantly in use. So, you know, I'm really getting, you know, I'm really using it a lot. It's a gadget which you love because you use it a lot. I'm also proud of the fact that they sponsor this podcast. I love their product. I love their company. I know a few of them there. They've got a great ethos, top people at that company. Go to cooker.co.uk. To look at the taps available to you and prices and everything else. If you can afford one, I really highly recommend it. Love it. Great bit of kit. Today's hour, I'm curious about acting in computer games. To be honest with you, if I'm really honest with you, I didn't really know this existed. Yeah, I actually thought it was just all computer generated. I had no idea there were actors who were doing motion capture stuff. This is really not something I knew about. So, look, there's a guy called Nolan North who's one of the biggest in the world. He's an actor. He's a voice actor too. And he's kind of pivoted. He still does some, you know, traditional work in TV and movies and stuff, but he's pivoted to working in gaming for gaming companies on video games. He's been in Call of Duty, obviously one of the world's biggest games, Uncharted, which is now, as we know, had a movie just out. He plays the lead character Nathan Drake. Batman, plays the Penguin. Avengers, Assassin's Creed. I mean, the list is endless here. There's just so many computer games or video games that he's been in. Anyway, let's find out more about him. Here's Nolan. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Where are we speaking to you from? Where are you based?
I am based for last year now in Atlanta, Georgia. I spent 25 years in Los Angeles and was just tired of not seeing any rain. So I decided to head to the East Coast.
Well, what made you decide Atlanta of all places?
Atlanta is actually one of the burgeoning TV and film area. So for the on-camera work I do, you know, everything is self-tapes now. So your agents just send you self-tapes. You know, a lot of things are shot in Vancouver, Canada, Toronto, and Atlanta now. Pinewood Studios, famously in London, had their Pinewood America, North America, was in Georgia. Marvel is now, it's called Trilith Studios. Marvel's down there, and Viacom's buying up a bunch of property. So in that end of the business, it made a lot of sense. The tax situation's a lot better. There is no drought. I almost lost a house in a fire a couple years back in California. And as far as voiceover is concerned, I'm speaking to you from the bunker. This is a little studio that I built in my home, and I do everybody there. You don't go to work anymore.
Yeah.
Last time I was in California, I actually had to do a voiceover job at Nickelodeon, and I got there expecting to see people. It's just security and the engineers. So everybody's remote now. So you can pretty much do anything from anywhere. And that's what I do.
Is there a mass exodus from California? We keep hearing about it, people moving to Texas and stuff like that. Is that the reality, though?
It is. It is the reality. It's really unfortunate. I mean, California is an absolutely beautiful state. As they say, you know, you can be surfing in the morning and skiing in the mountains by the afternoon. But it's just gotten really crowded. It's gotten really expensive. And the drought is severe. I mean, it's a severe people. They just June 1st, they just enacted a law, $10,000 fine if you're caught watering your lawn more than once a week. Mm-hmm. And nothing out there will survive your lawns and things like that. It'll turn into Phoenix. Yeah, you know, those kind of places where, you know, get your drought tolerant plants and put out your pebbles for a front lawn. But it's really unfortunate. I think the traffic, the drought, the tax situation has made it incapable for companies to, like I said, even there's very few TV shows shoot out there, because it's just, there's no tax. Right. Things still do, but, it's just so much more efficient, to go elsewhere. And I think it's really unfortunate. I see a lot of New York plates too, a lot of people in the Northeast. And I think gas is at $7-$8 a gallon in California right now in certain places. So, you know, economies go up and down. So, but I think there's a big reason to leave.
You know, I love the States. I really like it. Generally, I head for one of the major cities when I go there. It's sort of Miami or LA or New York or Chicago or somewhere.
Sure,
I do love it. But we're looking over at it at the moment. And look, this country's not great at the moment. I've got to be honest with you, since the pandemic, and you know, we're not happy with the people who are running the country, et cetera, et cetera. But looking over the pond at the moment, it looks like it's not a happy place. But that's what our media says. But what is it like for being American there at the moment? Does it feel the same way, or is it just our interpretation of it?
It's the strangest time in my lifetime I've ever seen. I think I'm not a very political person. I stay out of it. I'm informed enough, but I stay out of it. And I don't think this country has been this divided and divisive since the Civil War. It's the strangest thing where, my father was a big time Republican. My grandfather was a big time Democrat. And in the 1970s, they would go down to the basement and drink and laugh and sing and watch TV sports and yell at each other. But they had dialogue. And they spoke, and there was still respect. And out of it, you know, my father might have learned something and kind of had his opinion swayed. And the other side, the same for my grandfather. But people don't talk. You're either with us or you're against us. And there's this real anger I see. And I was a journalism student. I went to college and grad school for journalism, broadcasting, and then I was a reporter for a year. And my favorite thing that I was telling someone the other day is there used to be these things called newspapers. You remember newspapers? And I always tell people, well, where was the op-ed page? The op-ed is the opinion page, and that was in the back, because the function of a newspaper is you assumingly will read it from front cover to the back. So by the time you read through the newspaper, you will get to the op-eds, where they will give you opinion articles from both sides, mm-hmm. On the hottest topics of the front page and the stuff you're just read about. Well, now newspapers are dying breed, but we have the news. And it's my opinion, purely my opinion, that people are getting their news from the op-eds. The Tucker Carlsons, the Sean Hannitys, Don Lemons on the other side, and the Rachel Maddows, you know, from the more liberal side. Media is supposed to just be reporting. You're supposed to just tell what happened and everybody kind of figure out for themselves and discuss at the pub or around the family dinner table the issues. But now the people watch op-ed opinion news programs to get their news.
Yeah.
So they're being... If you are raised in the United States in a Fox household, you are fed one sort of opinion, and it's usually with a lot of vitriol and passion. So they're like, they must be right. And on the other side, it's the same way, with less vitriol, but it's a little more, you know, it seems to be level-headed. I truly don't know what is to believe anymore. So I watch both things. I try to watch both sides and try to pick through it. But I think that's the big problem with this country is you're fed one opinions, one side or the other. And I mean, there are kids when Donald Trump lost the election. First of all, when he won the election, We knew people at our kids' school, like elementary school, whose kids had to stay home. They were so upset. I'm like, really? Your 8-year-old was really upset over the presidential election. Oh, we're going to get them counseling because they're so upset. And then when Donald Trump lost the election, the other side, oh, our kids are so angry. Little kids in schools getting into fistfights because they have their MAGA hat and other kids picking on them. It's like, what are we doing? It's just, we look like a bunch of idiots.
Yeah.
So it's that's what I see in this country. I see two sides and it's really, really strange.
It's the same over here though. We're split on everything over here. And it just seems kind of, at the moment, everyone seems very down in America because of the guns and everything else. But let's talk about you, because
sure.
that's what you're on to do. So people might not recognize your name, but they probably recognize all the characters you've played in the computer games. I'm sorry, that's somebody at my door, but never mind about that. They recognize all the people you've played in the computer games. Can you name a few of them for us, please?
Well, most famously is probably Nathan Drake in Uncharted, which they just made the movie of with Tom Holland and Mark Wahlberg. Rocksteady in London
allowed me to be the Penguin, so I got to do Oswald Cobblepot for Rocksteady.
But Destiny's Ghost, Desmond Miles from from Assassin's Creed.
Yeah.
Dr. Richtofen from the Call of Duty zombie series. And those are just the games. Animation, I know a lot of kids that get Nickelodeon over there, Blaze and the Monster Machines. I do that that show. I was Raphael and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And for some of the younger girls, I was Peter Hastings on camera for the Pretty Little Liars show, which every time I go to the UK, I just get some girl look at me and go, "Aren't you?" And I'm like, yeah, that's me. So I'm the person that you didn't know you knew.
That's me. But when you started out, I read, obviously I did a little bit of research. Said you started off by trying to do stand-up comedy, and then you're obviously going into let me call it normal acting. I mean, that's not really the right way, but acting as we know it, you know, in TVs and stuff. And you had a little bit of success. How did the stand-up comedy go?
Stand-up comedy was fine. You know, the thing is, I was in New York. I was doing theater, and I just wanted to be – I wanted to perform. And I had gone through a bad breakup, and one night I had done it in college just on a lark just to win a bet with some friends. And then the owner of the club was like, "Hey, do you want to MC these shows?" So I was like, sure. I started doing that, and I was around comics. Then in New York, I went through a bad breakup, and I was making my friend laugh about it. He goes, "You should make this into an act." And it became kind of a therapy session where I'd go out and do some of the act. And then we started writing some more. And it was literally, sometimes I would do it. I was so broke, I'd do it for. There was one place I did stand up in the back, and you prayed people would show up. But it was for, you got a glass of draft beer, nothing imported. Because I liked, they had Bass Ale at the time, but no, you can't get Bass. So it was usually a Budweiser and a one appetizer. So that would be dinner. It'd be, you know, chicken fingers. That was a big deal. Mozzarella sticks and a beer. That, you know, because, so I literally worked for my supper. But you go around doing the stand up in between plays. I was doing a lot of theater at the time, and then ended up, packing everything up, one-way ticket to L.A. with some golf clubs and some clothes. Stayed in my car for a short time. I got a rent-a-wreck. Stayed in my car until a buddy of mine was going to move out to an apartment. So it wasn't like I had to, but I did, and it wasn't that big a deal. Just, here's the deal, sleeping in a car, you just find a nice neighborhood. That's pretty much. But I mean, they're really like, I told people, I'm like, "Where are you living?" I'm living in Malibu. I did. I'm the PCH. it was brilliant. And then I went to LA, and about 7 months after I got there, I landed a soap opera, a spinoff of the famous General Hospital, a show called Port Charles. And I had a 5-year contract with ABC, where I really learned, I got paid to learn how to do, to be a professional, you know, and it was a godsend because, you know, from there I started doing, television, you know, small guest spots on different shows. And, eventually a friend of mine just said, yeah, you should meet my voiceover agent. You're always goofing around with us with your voices. And that kind of set me off on a whole new course, which has kind of been my bread and butter for the last 20 years.
So did the voiceover work lead you into the computer game work?
Yes, yes. At the time when I first got in, I think somebody asked me, they said, oh, wow, you know, I was one of my biggest honors is I was presented with a BAFTA award for special distinction and kind of a lifetime achievement. And I was like, well, hell, I'm only 45. Why I'm not done. But the BAFTA is very important to me because I'm a bit of an Anglophile. I was raised on Fawlty Towers and Monty Python and, you know, just anything Alec Guinness did or Richard Burton did. My dad, that's what I had to watch just growing up. Not ever wanting to be an actor, just that's what my dad loved. And he was a Shakespeare major in college, so he loved that stuff. Somebody asked me, they said, you know, you're a pioneer in the gaming voiceover. It's just because I was lucky enough to be first. Trying to get into animation and do the things, the cartoons that were out at the time. Video games have never had residuals, so people kind of put their thumb their nose down. And my early jobs were really, you know, grenade, get down, you know, get to the hedgerow, that kind of stuff, in different accents, you know, World War II games. And just there were no voices in games. Presumably kids would put on headphones, listen to their music and just play the game. And early on, I took it as my job to, I looked at voiceover as, you shouldn't hear me. You shouldn't recognize me. We were more like the vocal sound effects, and the more immersive we could make that experience without taking away from it, I thought was important. You know, I think the play's the thing, right? So it's like, let's just try to blend in and make this more, more of an immersive experience. And then narrative games started happening. And all of a sudden I was the guy because I could go from, I tell people I could yell for 4 hours, have lunch and yell for another 4 hours. So I knew that people knew I was consistent. And people always ask my advice on acting. It's my advice to anyone in any business. Be the guy or girl or be the person that people want to work with. They want to ask back. Work begets work unless you're an asshole. So I always looked at it as like, I'm going to show up on time. And somebody taught me it's better to be 15 minutes early than on time. Be on time, get it done early, and have as much fun. Crack jokes, do other voices for people. You know, because then you form this bond with producers, with directors who are like, hey, you know what? Who'd be great at this? Let's call Nolan. So I just started working a lot. And that's why I think I have a pretty good size IMDb list. Games or even shows that I forgot I've done. But I was there early.
Did you always find it easy to do the accents? Is it something that came relatively easy?
Yeah. You know what? It to a certain point, you know, like I'll always have an Aussie tell me like, you know, it's not that good an Australian accent, but I tell him, oh, it's good enough to fool an American and it's all that matters, you know? With anything in the UK, you know, I'm trying to, I think I've gotten to the point where I have, you know, it's social class, you know, it's very, you can be very posh and, you know, but I'm trying to find, I want to work on like down there in Cornwall, because there's a certain way of saying words down there. where they say the R is a little harder. And so I Ireland just gets a little bit faster. They talk like that a little bit more. And in Scotland, it's a little more glottal. I think it's kind of like musicians who can play by ear rather than read music. There's certain ones I can kind of hear and I can just sort of start doing it. I think for a more, you know, if a role really required it, I would, I would work with an expert, but I got a great story about that. I was Gerard Butler's voice match for the How to Train Your Dragon video games that they came up. And what they did is then they did a How to Train Your Dragon series, animated series. DreamWorks did it. So they had me come in and do Stoic. Now, they got the entire cast except Craig Ferguson, was played by my friend Chris Edgerly, and me. I did Gerard Butler. I did Stoic. And we came in the first day, and it was me, and this woman was sitting in a chair, and this is very odd to have somebody sitting there in the booth with you. And they explained, this is Gerard Butler's speech coach for his accents, because apparently he's Scottish, but he grew up in Ireland, or he's Irish and he grew up in Scotland. I think he grew up in Ireland, but that's why his accent's a little strange. Well, we're doing, I don't know why the Stoic, the vast Viking is Scottish, but not some Nordic thing, but we start like hiccup. I want to talk to you about those dragons. And then it becomes, and she's like, no, dragons, you want to roll the R, dragons. Well, long story short, by the time we finished that first episode, it's like, hiccup, I want to talk to you about that dragon now. And it's not going to happen anymore. 1 week later, my next session, I have the same script. And I said, hey, we did this last week. They go, yeah. Now the voice coach is gone. Nobody could understand what the hell I was saying. It was too Scottish because she had every note on every single line. So when you're doing an accent like that, it's Scottish, but it's Scottish for an American audience. So hiccup, I want to talk to you about that dragon. I want to talk to you now. It's not, I want to talk to you about the dragon. We're talking about it now. So when people say, you don't really sound that, I'm like, I know.
Just changing it slightly. We have an unbelievable amount of Brits at the moment working in America as actors.
Yeah.
And I'm so shocked by it. And then someone explained to me the other day, it's because of tax relief, that if you start using people from outside the country, then you sometimes get some sort of tax relief. That's why Hollywood are using so many British actors. But they've all got these American accents. And to us over here, they sound all right. I'm wondering what the Americans are making of all the Brits coming over there with their American accents. Are they getting them right or not?
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, I think there's certain words that you can hear that kind of make my ear, I think my ear's a little more sensitive to it.
Right.
But I mean, Cumberbatch, I had a small role. I met Cumberbatch on Star Trek when he played Khan. J.J. Abrams was a big fan of the Uncharted games. So he put me on the bridge with Peter Weller. I was there for 2 weeks and I got to see Cumberbatch crush his head. Spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the movie. But it was great. Cumberbatch is great. There were a couple people on Pretty Little Liars that I had no idea were British because they would use their American accent.
Oh.
And Tom Holland, who I just did a cameo in the Uncharted movie with, I flew to Spain to do this cameo. And, you know, he'd be talking in his accent, you know, just like, Nolan, so great to have you here. And just being, you know, it's so brilliant. You know, they come down, the games have been great. Just want to do you solid. And then all of a sudden he just switched into the Nathan Drake, the American. And I was like, that's pretty good. And I remember thinking selfishly, I hope like when I do the British, they kind of go, yeah, that's passable. That's okay. That works. You know, it's like Alan Tudyk is a very good friend of mine who did Death at a Funeral. He's the crazy guy who's up on the naked on the roof of the house. He's an American. He's from Dallas, Texas. And there have been people and like, oh yeah, I thought he was British because one of his first roles right. was that. So I think it's, yeah. The only thing I ever heard, Tom said it's in the trailer too. He said, it's not anything you can find on a map. He says map. And it sounds like you're from Minnesota, map. It's like, right. It's a map.
Okay.
Meh. He kind of meh, like meh. Say mugs, meh. So no, but listen, I hope there's tax relief because I would love to do a series in the UK. Mm. I'm not trying to, you know, kiss ass here, but like London is my favorite city anywhere. It just is. I don't know why. I grew up near Boston, which is kind of the bastard cousin. Sorry about that. Yeah. Actually, every July 4th, my friend Graham McTavish, I say, hey, happy 4th of July. He goes, oh, yes, or as we call it, Good Riddance Day. So, but it is. It's like it did felt going to London for the first time. I remember it felt like, wow, I've been here. This is the strangest feeling of deja vu. Just so familiar. I have no problem navigating my way around the city for some reason. Weird. Maybe it's because I've watched so much TV and I've seen movies. I've seen it so much. So,
well, that's what it's like for us going to the States. Whenever I go to the States, I don't feel like I'm in reality. I always just feel like I'm in a movie. And I think that's why I like going there so much.
That's a good point.
Because I'm a TV presenter and I used to do a bit of voiceover work and generally for sort of adverts and stuff like that. And then I got to narrate a TV series. And what was, I always find interesting is it's, I can't act to save my life, but to do voiceover work is actually really tough and people don't understand how tough that is because when you're just in a booth, which is what you end up being, you know, you're not actually, you're just in a booth reading a script. You suddenly, all you can hear is your voice because you've got your headphones on and you can hear your voice. And then you've got to try and work out intonation. There's no moving body parts like you would do. Like I'm having a chat with you now and I'm talking to you on a video call thing, a Zoom. Right. You can actually see my hands moving, my facial expressions. It's easy. So then it's easy to put in the intonation with it. But when it's just you in a room on your own with a script, it's kind of a tough job, isn't it? I think people just assume you just stand there, you read a script, and that's it. You make a load of money. I think it's actually a harder skill.
Well, it's a different skill for sure. The one thing I think with on-camera stuff is, and this is an Alec Guinness thing, you create the character sometimes from the outside in. If you're playing a king and you have a crown and a big cape on, you know, it's, there's something about playing, I've played a lot of lawyers, and you put on a suit that they give you and a tie, you exude lawyer, and people are visually seeing that. So it's the one thing that's helps in on camera. Of course, in on camera, I am this, you know, it's very, I'm a doctor, I'm a cop, I'm a lawyer, whatever. Whereas in voiceover, you can be anything. I find it to be freeing. I try to kind of draw to the opposite of that thinking, the idea that I'm here, I can make this anything I want. The context, I when I do any kind of project, sometimes they'll give me just my lines. And I'm like, can you send me the full script? I want to read the other lines. I want to know what I'm responding to because this is acting 101. It's not acting, it's reacting. It's how sometimes there have been some games even that will do this where they'll play the line that the other actor, if they recorded before me, they'll play that line so I can actually respond to that line rather than just be reading something. I think voiceover directing is one of the a very underrated thing because a good director feeds you context, feeds you the situation so you're able to, you know, respond accordingly. Yeah, sometimes it's challenging when you're sitting in here alone. It's gotten easier because of, you know, I've done this for a long time, so I have a range of experience to fall back on. But I have two sons now, 22 and 19, who want to be both be actors. The 19-year-old specifically really wants voiceover. He loves it. And I think he's and my first thing is said, take acting classes. And I tell any person, I meet so many people at conventions and they say, I want to be a voice actor. I'm like, well, why don't you just be an actor? you know, well, I do all these voices. I'm like, well, learn to act with those voices. Because, and I tell everybody, an actor is an independent contractor, like a plumber. And you're never going to meet a plumber who says, I only work on toilets. It's like, oh, I need you to fix my sink. Nope, just toilet. I'm the toilet plumber. Why in a business when it's so difficult and can be so challenging, would you close the door to any form of payment? It's like, give me theater. You know, I tell people an actor's job is to deliver a performance. And whether I'm on a mic or in front of a camera or a live audience, it's the same thing when you break it down. If I'm here on the mic and I'm doing a character, like when I do the penguin, I literally will lower the mic. I have to, he has a bottle jammed in his eye in the game and he's all kind of hunkered up. So I will go down and I will do this kind of face. And I'll be, oh yeah, Batman. Because I can't, that doesn't sound the same if I don't do those things. Physicalize, do these things. You know, my favorite parts of voiceover alone in the booth is working with the people. And it's nice, you know, now it's all remote. So I'll be on a Zoom call or a Riverside call with someone and they'll be looking at me, tell me what they want. I'm like, okay. And we work out. We'll try to find a voice. It's like, well, he's kind of a stoner. So he's a stoner like this kind of thing. Yeah, but he's a little younger, so you go a little higher. Ha, 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 ha. And now you try to find like that kind of guy at the beach. He's like, totally wasted on the waves. And we'll find, you're like, no, 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 it's he's an old man. He's kind of crusty.
Oh, so he's older and he's crustier. And wait, no,
get rid of the New York. He's not.
Okay, so like maybe he's from down Texas and he made his way. It's like an older Matthew McConaughey. All right, boys.
And you're like, oh. Great. And I tell people, say, well, I can't do impressions. I'm like, you know what a bad impression is? There's no such thing as a bad impression. Bad impression is an original character. You can quote me on that. You just take, some people are like, I like to try to do a Sean Connery, but I can't. I'm like, well, take that Sean Connery that doesn't sound like Sean Connery, put a little accent on him, and now you got yourself a Southern man who just likes himself some sweet tea down by the river. It doesn't matter. It's use the visuals, use the context. It can be challenging, but the hardest part of voiceover is like what you said. Sometimes you're all alone in a booth.
Mm. Well, what's interesting to me is when I used to do them, it used to be for adverts generally and radio adverts and things like that. And I used to say to one of my mates who was really good at it and was like banging these out 3 or 4 a week or whatever. And I said to him, I keep on going into these things. They book me for like an hour and I'm taking the whole hour. You're in and out quickly. He goes, because there's a key to it. And I said, what's that? He goes, like, you got to look in there, right? And you've got a load of people who are standing there with the clients, right? And they've got to do their job and they've got to produce something. So never, this is his tip and it actually did work a bit. He goes, never ever do your best one first because they've got to go somewhere with it. They can't take the first one because that just doesn't make any sense to them. So always go in, be bland for the first one, a bit bland for the second one, but maybe a bit blander for a little bit more excited for the third one. Then the fourth one, you hammer it home with your best one, and they go, "That's the one we want." And then you get out of there. And I always thought that's a good idea.
That's brilliant. Actually, I'm going to use that. I still do audition for a lot of commercial stuff too. I don't know why. I have friends who just slay it. A commercial. I'd love to. My big thing is I was this close to being the voice of Infinity for the car. And that's the gig you want. Oh, man, I want a car campaign because it's just usually they'll send you like a lease on a car. So you got to have the right car company. You got to make sure you want it. But Yeah, I you know, actually, one of the adverts I did for Coca-Cola years ago was my first foray into realizing that this job can be done remotely from anywhere, because I walked into the booth in L.A., and it was two people on this. It was me talking to, like, some guy. It was actually a friend of mine, Tom Kane. He lived in Kansas City. And so he was at his home booth in Kansas City. He was doing remote before people did remote. The clients were in Atlanta, Georgia for Coca-Cola. And L.A., Kansas, and then there were the advertising team was in New York, all on one call. And we were in and out in 30 minutes, just did the, it was a simple thing. But I remember the first time I went, wow, you got the, you know, advertising team in New York, the clients are in Atlanta, the two actors are in Kansas City, Missouri, and Los Angeles. And we just did a spot, you know.
That's amazing.
And it was interesting. And now it's God knows where anybody is. I've done jobs from London. You know, they say, hey, we need something. So they'll find a studio in London. I go down and do my thing.
Talking about things becoming changing dramatically. You've been in the video game industry for over 20 years, haven't you, really? So
yeah.
You must have seen how much that must have evolved beyond recognition from what it was like 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, it was... Like I said, when I first got into it, we were vocal sound effects, not really, you know, characters. We, you know, just it was just to kind of help the experience. And then narrative storytelling came in. Amy Hennig with Uncharted, and then, you know, the Assassin's Creed series and Last of Us, Naughty Dog. And I mean, it just became... motion capture. You know, one of the other things is I was one of the first people outside of stunt people to get in a motion capture suit. Sony, the first game, they did a thing called NBA The Life, and I played, it's an NBA basketball game, way ahead of its time. And I was like the Jerry Maguire sports agent, taking the kid, calling the kid. And you took them from his winning the college championship through to his first year to getting drafted. And there was scenes where we'd go up into, you know, different companies trying to sway him. But I remember walking in the first day and these put us in these suits and the markers. I'm like, this is crazy.
Yeah. So let me just explain that. It's like a suit with like ping pong balls all over it, isn't it? That's the motion capture.
Yeah.
We've all seen that with the footballers over here when they do adverts and things. Yeah. Go on.
Yes, exactly. And Andy Serkis is one of the most famous who's done it for Gollum, for Planet of the Apes. By the way, if he happens to listen to this, I want to work with you desperately. Just want to work with Andy Serkis. I got to go to his Imaginarium. I spoke at a school in London, outside London, over by Ealing Studios, and got to see the Imaginarium. So I want to go there. I want to work with you, Andy. Anyway, they were polls all over the set with cue cards because everybody else had never done on camera. And I had memorized my script just because that's what I had been doing for forever. But it was like doing theater. It was great. I ended up doing some Navy SEALs SOCOM thing, which is funny because I'm like the lead Navy SEAL. And they had real Navy SEALs teaching me and were my team. And, you know, like the guy's like, yeah, what you want to do is you want to go up here. You want to hold the gun like this. You're like, these are the hand signals. And at one point I'm going, why don't you just let me voice, let him do this and I'll voice him, which they may have done anyway. But with Nathan Drake, when I did Iron Man, Tony Stark, these were all motion captured. And it became much more of, now you're working with other actors. It's theater. And they take that data, and whereas it's the same process that, you know, Andy Serkis or anybody on Avatar would have done, Tintin with Jamie Bell and Andy Serkis, they take that data and put it in a film, or they take that data and they put it in a video game. All my stuff has gone to video games, but that's how we did it. And it was great. It was like, it felt like black box theater. You know, people say this, but there's nothing around visually. I'm like, yeah, or there's everything. It's your imagination. It's a playground.
Well, that's why I was watching some footage of you do it before we came on to this call today. And I watched a before and after, and it's very physical, isn't it? Because it's computer games, it's moving, things are happening.
Yeah.
And then what's quite strange about it is I was watching a scene in a Jeep, you know, where your Jeep turns over and stuff. It's brilliant. But whilst you're doing that, it's like, how are you imagining all this? Do they build the game around what you've done, or have they told you how is it all working?
They kind of, it's worked differently. In the early games, they actually brought in an actual Jeep that I had to run and jump in. Then for the second game, they realized we don't need an actual Jeep. We can build it out of these wood blocks and give him a steering wheel. And they did that. By the third game, they said, we don't even need the blocks. We just need a chair and a steering wheel because the blocks will hide the markers and they don't get all the data. And by the fourth game, there was a steering wheel and like a clear chair. And the stick shift is a piece of pipe with a tennis ball on it, you know. That was it. So it got pared down the more they started understanding the technology. But I think you just tap into your imagination. I tell people, you know, sometimes the best actors are kids when they're in the backyard, you know, and they're in their clubhouse. And that clubhouse one day is a pirate ship, one day it's a spaceship. It could just be a clubhouse. But the thing is the stick is a lightsaber or whatever they want it to be, and they don't question it. And you, the more open, the less self-conscious you can be, and just realize that you have to, like I said before, know the context and play the situation. And you know, when you have great actors around you, you're playing off them and their energy and doing stuff. The one thing I tell people, they sit there, this is Nolan North. He's the voice of Nathan Drake. And it's like, I'm becoming that old guy going, it's not just the voice, son. I also do the motion capture, all that. Cause I did all that running and jumping and, you know, the rolling and, you know, you kind of want people to know. It's like, I did all that. It was hard. It was a lot of work.
Do you get to live out the character? Is there an equivalent of Comic-Con with games, or do you get to go to Comic-Con? Does it work that way?
I was just in Liverpool a couple of weeks back. I was supposed to be in London and I got ill and ended up, I had to come back home, but I'm doing a lot of conventions. And I remember the first time I was in London for some expo. I remember they were like, people are quite excited to see you. 3-hour queue. And I went, wow, 3-hour queue is a line. I said, yeah. I said, what, they weren't, what are they lining up for? She goes, it's for you. I'm like, no. But I mean, I know they want to see the Uncharted thing, but what, they go, no, that's your line.
Wow.
To come see. And I was blown away. I was blown away. The greatest thing about that particular job, and I guess most of my work, is the fact that especially Nathan Drake is this globe-trotting adventurer. That character has allowed me, a kid from pretty simple means in New England, to globe-trot. We have done Comic-Cons. We've had publicity things in Oslo, Berlin, Jordan, Italy, Spain, Australia. I've been able to go all over this country. I always wanted to travel when I was younger. I always just loved different, loved the way people sounded. I love different cultures, food, drink. I eat that stuff up. And I think the ironically beautiful thing is that this most famous character I ever had allowed me to travel just as much as the character had. And while he's globetrotting for certain treasures, that's what I've found my treasures, usually in a pub somewhere. Liquid treasures.
Does it work the same way as acting in a film or something? The more successful it is, I mean, some actors just get paid a flat fee, but then sometimes when you get bigger and well better known, they sort of pay you on the success of the product. Does it ever work like that in the gaming industry?
Yeah, certainly did. And Uncharted certainly worked like that. You know, especially with this is a big bone of contention with a lot of actors. There's no residuals that like there is in television and film.
But you better explain what residuals is for people.
Residuals are basically every time a show, you get paid a salary to do a show. When that particular show is re-aired on, if it streams now, there's a percentage every time somebody streams it, a percentage goes to a residual pool, which then is divvied out amongst the actors and some to the writers, the producers, but it's usually a very small percentage. I used to get residual checks. You get thousands of dollars, or I had a collection of 1 penny, 2 cents, three pence. 4 pence. I mean, I actually had it stacked I still have one that's, I once got a check. I don't know why they did it. It's computer generated. That was for $0.00.
Nice.
It cost somebody money to print a check for nothing. What it does is there's just, and in video games, there's no way to monitor replaying. You can't really monitor that. A rerun, every time something replays anywhere in the world, different markets, there is residual structure built in. There isn't one for gaming. And that's why I think a lot of actors were kind of like, I don't want to do that. I'm not going to do that. With the success of shows, Blaze and the Monster Machines is a Nickelodeon show that I do.
I've watched so much of that, I tell you, because when my kids
go on. Come on, count with me. We're going to learn all about trajectory today. Let's blaze.
Yeah, so we're in our seventh season. Fortunately, I get paid a little bit more. But at the beginning, I do a lot of Rick and Morty. I've done Family Guy. I've done American Dad. All these different shows. And it's pretty much based on a scale payment. Scale is around $1,000, I think, for a session. Now, that session may take you 15 minutes. It may take you 2 hours. And those you typically are just like, look, this is what we pay. If you don't want to do it, we'll find somebody else. Unless you're a series regular. So Blaze has, you know, after seven seasons, yes, that there is a bump each year, a small bump. It's nothing huge. It's not certainly not, you know, Robert Downey Jr. Iron Man money. There's not that kind of thing. But you know, I think that it doesn't matter. My joy comes from the variety of things that I get to do. I was doing some introspection recently, and I thought about, gosh, you know, I always thought I wanted a show, you know, like that one big show, that Law and Order show or something, and make all your money playing that guy. And I see those guys at conventions, and they are that, they have that picture of themselves from that show. Whereas my table may have 15 different things because somebody brings their kids up for Blaze. Then somebody wants my photo from Pretty Little Liars, that show, or then it's Iron Man, or it's Nathan Drake, or it's Deadpool. I do the Deadpool animation and gaming. It's Call of Duty. It's I love the diversity of the roles I've been able to play.
And also a lot of the people who will be watching you on the video games would probably never interact with a sort of Law and Order or something, those TV shows. You know, they're not watching traditional television. They're playing video games or they're streaming things. They're not actually being served via the normal channels, which we've got terrestrial channels over here. I know you've got your cable over there. So they would never have seen you unless you're appealing to this mass market of people who are gaming, which is absolutely huge, isn't it?
Yeah, I think a lot of my I've never really set out to be recognizable and famous. I just, that was a byproduct. It's not something I ever really cared for. I think it was Bill Murray said, isn't it great to be rich and famous? And he said, rich is good. Famous, not so much. But I think it, for me, it was, you know, I think Google, I owe a lot of my recognizability to Google, because I think people like, hey, I really enjoyed that game. Who was that? And they look it up and then they put the face to the name. But at conventions, I cannot tell you how many stories I hear of people going, so my girlfriend's watching this TV show. My wife's watching this show called Pretty Little Liars. I'm making a sandwich. I hear this voice and I run in and I go, that's Nathan Drake. And she goes, no, that's Peter Hastings. He goes, no, that's the... And he said, I didn't know you did. There are people who have no idea that I do voiceover that right. have watched a couple of the few shows I've done. Then there's people who didn't know I do on camera. And, you know, it just is what it is. It's like, I said, I'm an independent contractor. You know, if there's you pay me enough, I'll show up to your bar mitzvah and do a song and dance.
So 20 years you've been working in video games and stuff, over 20 years, I believe, and you've been watching that industry. It went through a bit of a dodgy stage for, I think it's come out the other end where people blamed it for a lot. I think now smartphones have taken over. That's where we like to lay the blame for things, you know, people's lack of attention, everything. And I think gaming has sort of come out of the other end where people are appreciating that people are getting a lot out of it and enjoying it if you don't do it too much. But there was some horror stories, wasn't there, 10 years ago, and they were like, these things are ruining all our lives, ruining society. And do you remember that era of it?
Oh, of course. Yeah. No, and some moron will say something that somebody just recently came out. I think, you know, with these mass shootings, and then a couple of the right-wing politicians, I think it was the right wing, just said this and video games. It's like video games are all shown all over the world. Uncharted, Call of Duty is played all over the world. They don't have mass shootings like this country does. They don't. So that argument is just beyond ridiculous. If anything, I think a video game, even if it's a shooter, would release that kind of, need. Steve Bloom, a good friend of mine and a great voice actor, he was at a military event, and he met met some military guys who thanked him. And he told me the story, said they were, you know, over in the Middle East. And he said, they'd come back in from maneuvers and firefights. And they would, he said, your game, we'd sit down and play that Call of Duty and just de-stress. And he was like, really? You go and play a video game after you're out there in firefights? He goes, oh yeah. He said, you don't understand how important video games are. Said, because we'll get a satellite signal that's there for a bit, and guys are jumping on playing with their children back home, their friends back home. It's a sense of normalcy. It's just something that takes you away. It's a stress reliever to us. And I'm not saying, hey, look at how great we are. It's not my point. My point is, I never knew that there was... I grew up in the era when... It was, oh, you're playing. I didn't play video games. I don't. I was like, my dad was like, if you're not watching Bridge on the River Kwai, go outside and play. That was his thing. It was like, so we weren't allowed to watch a lot of TV necessarily until a certain hour. You know, get your homework done, go outside. I was outside. And games at the time was Pong. I mean, we did, you know, Atari, button and a joystick.
Yeah.
So it wasn't anything that I gravitated towards.
But do you think it's come out the other side? Because, you know, you'd sort of say the way it was perceived in the world often was like, you know, oh, like the adult industry, that's bad for everybody, and then the gaming industry, video games, that's terrible for our children, it's killing our children, it's ruining
rock
their
and
lives.
Roll, rock and roll, and Marilyn Manson, and right, rock and roll. Sure.
Do you think it's come out the other end now? Because it doesn't seem to me that apart from you're right with the mass shootings the other day, people don't seem to be as down on it anymore. It seems to be there's a console in everybody's house, or people are playing it on their computers or smartphones, and it seems to be just part and parcel of life now.
Yes, I agree. I think it has come out the other side, and I think that's because the generations now who are parents have grown up with it. So they, you know, there's people in their 30s and 40s. I remember I went down to Florida to see my brother's family, and my niece works in the medical industry, and there's a pediatric heart surgeon who is a huge Arkham fan, and he just wanted to meet the Penguin. And I'm like, really? He goes, oh, after surgery, I just lock in. I have my room where my wife lets me, I go and play. And I'm like, this guy is a children's heart surgeon. And he wants to meet my stupid ass. I thought that was just, yeah. So I think gamers have become, it's become visually stunning. There are beautiful musical scores. It's really well acted stuff out there. There's great narrative storytelling where you are the hero. I tell people, like, Uncharted is an amazing game franchise. I'm Nathan Drake until you pick up that controller, and then you're Nathan Drake. You're the one doing this. One of the most moving people I ever met in that first time, that three-hour queue that I had in London, was this gentleman in his mid-50s. Almost 60. And I'm a constable. He was a constable somewhere. He says, I know I'm never going to have the life, mate, that Nathan Drake, I'm never going to get to go on adventures. I get up every morning. I have my tea. I go to work. And that's my life. And that's how it's going to be till the day I die. He just went on. And I had a lump in my throat. He goes, but I get to go. And I'll stop doing his accent. I'll get to go and play as Nathan Drake and have these adventures and have these. He said, and this experience has filled my life somehow and giving me such pleasure as if I've gone those places there myself. Now, I'm not saying that to, like, wow, aren't I great? Pat me on the back. I'm talking about the industry. I'm talking about a place like Naughty Dog, a developer like Rocksteady that gives people these immersive experiences that are genuine, and I think they do more good than bad. There's people out there who love FIFA, a game that I was familiar with. I'm never going to play in the Premier League, never going to get to La Liga, but you get to go and now there's tournaments where people go and get to compete playing FIFA.
Oh, so, but the esport industry is off the scale. The billions of people who tune in, the money at stake, the teams, the training and everything.
Well, that's
we sit around in Britain talking about soccer, or as you call it, football, and it is kind of the biggest sport in the world, though it is argued esports are bigger. The World Cup is huge, but esports is absolutely massive in the world. It's just kind of slightly underground because it's not on all our terrestrial channels where people are watching it and stuff. But I do remember having lots of conversations with a sports broadcaster when, you know, over here going, I think we should broadcast the esports because we should buy the rights to that because it's just absolutely bloody huge. So, you know.
And you nailed it. People not only play it, people watch people play.
Yeah, that's it.
That became the big thing. I mean, you know, narrative games. There are people who watch. Sony did a whole marketing campaign of television adverts where the guy comes full frame on the TV, goes, Sony, you got to help me. I want to play Uncharted, but my girlfriend thinks it's a movie. And the girl walks in behind with popcorn. You ready to watch Uncharted? And it became this game where people got engrossed in the story, thanks to the great writing and the visuals. I think that's something where, and just to make the point about movie industry, the reason video game movies have had such a difficult time translating to the big screen from a game is that, like I said before, you're the player. So when they do a one-to-one adaptation, you know, you're taking away that personal experience and making somebody sit there passively and watch. That's why I think Uncharted with Tom Holland did a great job, because their focus is like, where was Nathan Drake in his 20s? The games never address that. So they are going to that decade to tell new adventures of Nathan Drake. And so, but people go, yeah, he doesn't look like Nathan Drake. I said, yeah, but by the time he's 30, he could. And they go, oh yeah, I guess he could. You're like, yeah, let it be its own thing. And Tom is a fan of it. I thought he did a phenomenal job. I thought the director, Ruben Fleischer, nailed the humor and got the relationships. And, you know, it did really, really well. And despite my cameo.
Listen, Nolan, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been wonderful speaking to you. If people want to follow you, where's the best place? Where do you on social media, where's the best place to follow you?
Well, I have my – I show up there every now and then. Again, I'm not too big. But at @Nolan_North on Twitter. And Instagram, I forget my – really Nolan North. So I'll troll it. It's usually when I'm just kind of bored and I'll flip through it. I'm not super active.
You're not on Instagram, because I was looking at earlier. You've hardly posted.
I am.
You've got to start posting more on Instagram.
But you got to pick a picture. You got to take a picture.
Oh, yeah.
It's like Twitter. My kids get mad at me because I like Instagram. I'll go through that and, I'll find, but.
Get your kids to do it. Pay them a few quid.
I know. I should do it. Well, who knows? Then it's like, wow.
Yeah. No, thank you so much. It's been real.
Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure speaking to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care.